If everybody wants to take their seats, we're going to get started. Everybody sit down, please. Come on. Hey, Noah, can you hear this in the back? There's a whole bunch of seats open in the front. So if everybody from the back wants to come to the front, you're allowed to. Hey, Stacy, there's a chair in the front. All right, we're going to get started here, and we really appreciate everybody coming out. Tonight, Slow Green Build and Sierra Club and Surf Rider are happy for everybody to look at some different ideas as regarded appropriate technology and water conservation, and have Jonathan Todd talk to you a little bit about different wastewater systems that use bioremediation strategies. And there's been a lot of work going on. Volunteer writer who's back there, and myself and Andrew Christie from Sierra Club and some others, we're lucky to have a presentation from Mark over here, Mark Hutchinson. And he is, I guess, the first environmental director for the Public Works for Slo County. And that's a really great thing that at this point in Slo County, we do have somebody in charge of looking at the environmental protection as related to public works. So I just want to give Mark a chance to come up here and just give you an idea of what the Public Works Department is doing in a positive way to help us with a healthy watershed. So here's Mark.
Well, good evening. My name is Mark Hutchinson, and my official title is Environmental Programs Manager for the San Luis Obispo County Department of Public Works, which just barely fits on a business card. I do want to point out, I think more people out there know who I am than I know who you are. I guess that's the evils of television, and I've been spending quite a few nights in Los Osos working on various projects and whatnot. Paavo asked me to come tonight and give you about 2 minutes without putting too many people to sleep, talk about what the county government and the Public Works Department is doing in particular as we move into the 21st century. As Michael said, I am the top-rated environmental manager that the Public Works Department has ever had. Also the middle-rated and the lowest-rated at the same time. Our beginnings were very humble and very recent. In the mid-1990s, a department called the Engineering Department, you might have heard of them, was in the business of building roads and bridges and water systems and whatnot, and they ran afoul of regulations that were put out by the state and federal government relating to environmental requirements. I've been a county employee for 18 years and a county resident for going on 52 years, so I'm somewhat familiar with the environmental concepts and requirements that exist in the county. After a lot of hand-wringing and whatnot, and as you can imagine, the county doesn't move that fast, we created something called the Environmental Division and changed the name of the Engineering Department to Public Works. My role in the Public Works Department is multifaceted. The basic role is to bridge the gap between public works and environmental requirements of regulatory agencies. But we found as we start getting into that there were a lot of issues and a lot of concepts that just weren't being integrated into our day-to-day operations in the manner that they needed to be. So we've expanded our role and expanded our influence. Very quickly, one management program itself is very detailed, has a lot of fingers and components to it. It will change the way the Public Works Department operates, the way the county operates, the way we develop land, and the way we manage stormwater. One of the fun concepts, though, is something called low-impact development, or LID for short. Low-impact development looks at our urbanized areas, and we try to figure out ways that we can return sites or build new sites in ways that mimic their natural conditions as far as rainfall. So you'll see in the back of the room things like bioswales and others. Those are actually being implemented in our county today by the Public Works Department, of all people. Now, I will tell you that we're not all that progressive. There is a mandate out there that's coming up, so we're working very hard to learn the new ways of doing things before the federal government comes in and hits us over the head with a big stick. Believe it or not, our little old San Luis Obispo County and our small Public Works Department and our 7-person Environmental Programs Division have found ourselves, according to the regional board, in the forefront of low-impact development implementation in the entire west coast of California, which is surprising to me. But our approach to things these days is teamwork and partnering. So we approach LID and projects with that same concept. As a result, we've hooked up with Slow Green Build and other organizations to try to find common ground in ways that government and community organizations and communities and members of the communities can work together to achieve all of our goals all at the same time. We know that that's a significant challenge, but it's not any fun if you don't challenge yourself for that. So I encourage everybody to listen to this presentation and the speakers, to talk to each other about these ideas and share concepts, look at the boards and the posters around the room, and as many of you I can talk to before my voice gives out tonight, I'll be glad to do that. So welcome.
All right, a little brief background. The Slow Green Build has a branch to them called the technical team, and they do several different things. But what we're here tonight talking about is the appropriate technology campaign they've initiated. And it was nice, back in July of 2007, Pavo Ogren, who's Mark's organizing boss, he invited Surf Rider and Sierra Club and Slow Green Build in to talk about what could we do beyond the wastewater, but to look at the individual business and the residents and say, what can we do to lower the impact on the wastewater? Educational events out to the public, to the government agencies, to the professional services, to look at these different ideas. And as, if you walk down the line here, you kind of see in order the way the water is hitting our earth. And we have the bioswales, we have the permeable paving, the stormwater gardens. You look at the rainwater catchment systems, the energy-efficient appliances, dual-flush toilets, low-flow appliances. And then you get into composting toilets and some more radical things in the bioremediation. And you get an idea that's really an integrated approach, and it's not all about hiring a firm to come in and solve a solution, but it's about all of us working together and doing a little bit in our own way, in our own house, to really implement these solutions. So we're really excited about the grants and the project, working with the Public Works, working with Surf Rider, Sierra Club, and it's nice to see the government and the nonprofits really working together on these ideas. Some of the things we look at when we look at what we can do is, how much do the occupants have to change their behavior? If everybody has to completely change their behavior, it's going to be hard to get acceptance. If you can't find the resources in the community, either the services or the technology, we can't implement the solutions. If it costs us an armful, we won't be able to do it. So the question is, how can we fit all these things in so we have this social, economic, and ecological solution? And that's the real balance, this triple bottom line type of idea. And that's, you know, we brought Jonathan out here. He's just one person. We could have brought tons of people out here, but what they really look at is that triple bottom line, a social justice, social equity type thing, a healthy ecology, and a prospering economy. And that's just an example of it, and that's why we really wanted to bring him out here. So I'm going to let Noah kind of take over and talk about all the different people that were involved here to make this happen and show our appreciation.
Good evening, and I am Noah Smuckler with the Surf Rider Foundation, a Morro Bay resident, and would like to start by just giving our appreciation to all of you for your perseverance and your commitment to analyzing and being involved with a discussion that is related to one of our most vital assets, and that's our water cycle and our water supply. And we are continually impressed with the passion that you bring to the table, and at times it has gotten very flared, and in some ways rightfully so, because if you can't get impassioned about an issue like water, what is it that will bring out your fights and your growl and those things that really help keep it up, and really we hope to eventually look back on the situation and feel thankful for all the effort that's been put into the process and the ultimate the ultimate solution. And some of these things here tonight are great examples of what we can do and where we can go in the future and make a big impact with potentially just some shifts in philosophy and how we go about developing the land that we live and living and coexisting and interacting with that land. So with that, we'd like to say thanks to a couple of the key businesses that and supporters that have really helped us continue this dialogue and the work that's being done in many cases by volunteers and committed professionals who like to put forth a little bit of free time and play in their passion or whatever it is. And Slow Green Build, Surf Rider Sierra Club, Hope Dance. We're just but a few of the many people within our communities that are making a difference. But we've had some help. We have Cayucas Brewing Company in the back there pouring beers and wine for us. And they have certainly supported us. Steve Haney and his crew have been phenomenal. American Flatbread Pizzas, which there's plenty more in the back, and the volunteers cooking them up. Those guys out in Los Alamos, but they have some great pizzas that they sell in the frozen goods. These are the local businesses and services that, as we grow as a community, really are, this is the lifeblood of who we are and our culture. And as we move along with this process and we potentially start to define ourselves more and more as leaders of taking care and interacting with our environment in a way that is a long-term potential and long-term beauty. And with what we have here and the potential throughout the county to implement projects that exhibit this leadership, we not only will grow our local economy through tourism, but we'll be protecting what we value the most, and that's our environment. So it's very important to acknowledge the value of what we do and taking care of that. So our other guests and businesses that have really pitched in, Slow Chai, and also Sweet Earth Organic Chocolates. So that's our crew. In the back, we have a silent auction that is loaded with it is with great pleasure that we, Slow Green Build, Surf Rider, Hope Dance, Sierra Club, introduce and welcome our guest, Jonathan Todd, a man who has a great lineage of family and ties to people that have been really looking at this issue of water management and coexistence for many years now, dating back longer than I've been alive. And really some of the leaders, like Michael said, of adjusting how we look at business and how business coexists with the people that they're serving. So I would like to invite Mr. Jonathan Todd from Todd Ecological up. A visitor and a friend from across the Great Divide and here from Cape Cod, the other side of the big one, the United States of America. And actually, before we get rolling here, I would like to present, because we hope Mr. Todd doesn't come back and visit and be involved, because it's been a pleasure to host you and to see your ability to collaborate and to approach a situation in a way that respects the effort that's gone in the past and hopefully into the future. So with that, we've got by Forever Stoked. This is a T-shirt that was designed for us. Of course, looking from the north back at our fondest vision, the Morro Rock, the great beauty of the coast. And we give this to you, sir, for all the great work you've done for watersheds around the world.
What a great shirt. What a great group of people. It's been an honor to work with. I'm kind of short. It's been a real honor to work with a community that's as committed. And even at times when things are fractious, when you see a community that's as committed and people within the community that are as committed, that you can allow yourself hope. I come from Cape Cod, and which maybe I'm being unfair to my hometown, but I feel that they are a somewhat less committed community, a less involved community. And 10 years ago, when everybody, one thing about being a Cape Codder is when you have to make ends do, like around here, because the cost of living is high, you do dump runs. You overriding factor that everybody has to keep in mind is we got to keep the nitrogen out of that estuary by any means necessary. And what I'm going to show you are examples of problems that we used ecological design to solve. And ecological design is just looking at how nature would do it and engineering systems to enhance how nature would do something. So really Mother Nature gets all of the credit. We just sort of exploited her and trademarked her and got the awards. But it's really, it's all based on natural systems. And so I'm going to show you just a whole series of systems that we've done. And I'm not suggesting that these are necessarily what are for the proper ones for Los Osos or the solutions for Los Osos, but I think that the lesson that can be imparted is that there are systems that are natural that can use less energy and require less infrastructure that can achieve the same means as the more highly mechanized chemical type systems. That being said, you're still better off with a highly mechanized system than nothing. So I'm just going to go through and I'm going to explain a little bit about any slide. If anybody has a question, stop me. Or if I get too long-winded, stop me. So here we go. Nice place. Wouldn't want to see that one go. And here's one of the favorite quotes that I have, and there's another one. Oh, this isn't going to behave for me. A sustainable society is one that can persist over generations, one that is far-seeing enough, flexible enough, and wise enough not to undermine either its physical nor social systems of support. That's a Donella Meadows quote on sustainability, and I think that really works. This computer is going to cause me to swear and regret. This here is a slide that I really don't particularly like, but I can't get away from, and it just shows all the analogies that we, or all the elements of nature that we borrow from when we create or inoculate one of our systems. In the background, you see the analogy for the stream, even though it's in a vertical form. We've engineered a stream to flow in a vertical form to take advantage of that ecology within a confined footprint. Next, in the middle ground, you see these plant-based technologies could work in a cold climate, in an basically unheated greenhouse. The greenhouse was heated for operator comfort up to 50 degrees in the winter. But this is a geographical area which commonly gets below 20 below zero. And it did meet all the EPA standards over the five-year pilot and more, as you'll see in forthcoming. But a lot of what I see in Los Osos is it's a sort of a clustered community, and you might get that MIMBY syndrome going pretty strongly. And one of the things that I wanted to show you is that this particular wastewater treatment plant wasn't that unpleasant a place to be. I think my slides are cropping a little bit, and I apologize. This is actually true that neighbors to the wastewater treatment plant would bring their dinner guests over before dinner and give them tours of the plant. And there was no aversion to it being there. There's been a lot of aversion to it since it's been closed, and that people want to see it going again. That's just a process flow diagram of the South Burlington Wastewater Treatment Plant. It treated about the equivalent of 1,200 homes, or 80,000 gallons per day. That's 500 homes. One of the leaching sites that I saw yesterday was large enough at an acre and a half. If this was 7,500, at an acre and a half could be almost capable of providing enough area to treat all of the wastewater for at least the prohibition zone. if not most of Los Osos wastewater, if the decision is to go with a centralized system, or whether lots of decentralized systems or just a few. And that's a very complicated question, which I'm happy to address later on. So, using nature's wisdom as a matrix, eco-machines accelerate nature's own water purification process. Eco-machines incorporate helpful bacteria, fungi, plants, snails, clams, and fish that thrive by breaking down and digesting organic pollutants, pollutants that normally deprive water of oxygen. And basically, that's based on the principle of nature, there's no waste, and that any of these nutrients are actually food for somebody, and you just have to. In the eco-machine at South Burlington, and that water wasn't supposed to be handled or touched because it wasn't disinfected, but it did. It was, and it was consistently, it met over the five-year pilot, the EPA, or Vermont State Swimming Quality Standards, and it was monitored on a weekly basis by an EPA-certified laboratory. So it wasn't internal analysis we were doing. We were using an EPA-certified laboratory. This gets into a further conversation, which we won't have time for tonight, but this is what the state and the EPA want to look at, and that's the in terms of the waste. They're not looking at all the other issues that we may have in our water, but biological oxygen demand, or the strength of the waste, or the amount of oxygen required to remove that strength is one. Here you see it going out with the average 213 and coming in 213 milligrams per liter. The average going out is 0.1, 0.4 rather, or 4 milligrams per liter. Suspended solids, again, maybe it's not the best indicator of the strength of the waste, but again, we were able to remove it far beyond our design parameter, which was 10 milligrams per liter, and we averaged 5 milligrams per liter. Total ammonia, we designed for 1 milligram per liter, we hit 0.3. Now, getting back to the turkey baster theory, a lot of wastewater treatment expense is the creation and hauling and disposal of sludge. Well, these are a bunch of non-union workers with really bad benefits and very low cost to us, but what we found is they would consume a large percentage of the sludge, and not only that, when they died, they had the courtesy to break down and provide a micronutrient for the bacteria that was consuming the waste. And so this was this sort of endless symbiotic cycle between the snails and the bacteria. And in one system, we thought, well, if snails can do it, maybe koi can. And the koi were able to reduce the sludge in a system in Frederick, Maryland. And we've also found there was a secondary economic opportunity in the fact that we bought them for $1 a piece as fingerlings and sold them for $9 a piece as 9 months later. All this time, they're reduced, which is M&M Mars's really high-end chocolate. This is a system that was very high waste, high-strength waste. Again, you can see the polishing ponds in the background. You can see a sliding roof to cover that during the high heat months. This is a photograph that I took last April down in Naples, Florida, at the Corkscrew Swamp, which is an absolutely beautiful natural cypress swamp. And because of the sensitivity of cypress swamps to nutrients, that had to be zero discharge. And this old eco machine had been clunking away for over 12 years without any problems. The only problem with it was, ironically, the state of Florida mandates that you have to use chlorine and chlorination and dechlorination prior to reusing this water in your toilets. And that had caused the director of the Audubon Society more frustration than the entire system in itself. So that was good design, bad law. And I talked to a lot of really committed members of the government and citizens here, and that's one of the things that people are running into is how to implement some of these best practices. And sometimes there's not a lot of freedom of choice that you have to do A in order to get to B, and you can't always do the best practices as quickly as you'd like to, and it's very frustrating, and I don't have any answers other than, well, I just don't have any answers. Yep. This is one in Findhorn, Scotland. The next one was we found that we were running into both impaired natural bodies of water, but also industry uses lagoons quite a bit, as many of you know, for wastewater treatment. This was Tyson Chicken, and they'd been fined $5 million for having ammonias over 11 milligrams per liter that were discharging right through this little culvert pipe into the Chesapeake Bay watershed. And so they thought it would actually be cheaper to fix the problem than to keep getting fined. So they hired us, and we were able to retrofit their lagoon for less than a dollar a gallon, which is unheard of in the industry. And during that year, prior to us coming, they were pumping their solids once a week. We reduced their energy demands by 74%, and during the year of operations where we had access to their data, we were still digesting the sludge blanket downwards or backwards. So they were no longer having to haul sludge. They saved over $150,000 in electricity during that year of operation, all that time remaining around 2 milligrams per liter or less for ammonia, so they were not fined. You can see here how and it's less toxic in its manufacturing process, and it is 100% recyclable. There were 3 acres of fabric underneath this, both for baffling in order to direct the water, but also as attached growth for the bacterial communities that we've discussed. We use all native wetland plants from the Chesapeake Bay, Maryland area. We used over 125 species, and over 100,000 plants were planted that first spring. We had to protect them because it was a big flyway from geese during their infancy, but they didn't require protection long, as you will see in this slide. That's between June and October. Another use of the restorer that we found, actually the first restorer, which was Restorer 1, was on Flash Pond. But more and more we're finding, because of stormwater, like we've discussed earlier, and because of septic systems nearby ponds, that ponds, and also because rain is just now more acid and there's just more ambient nitrogen in rain, that ponds are less and less able to digest their leaf litter every year and the sediment that goes in them, the organic sediment that goes in them. So they're becoming impaired. They're filling in. Invasive species are able to take a foothold because they become shallower. There's all these bad things that are happening at ponds, and so many ponds we're finding need some sort of a jump start to get going, and so this was another application for the restorer that we thought. This one was for not a very noble cause. This was for a Four Seasons resort, and it was their fifth hole golf course pond. But what we're proudest of this project is they were proposing to use 100 horsepower, 60 to pull water from the aquifer in order to turn the water enough over so you would never see an algae bloom. The other 40 was to get it back down a deep injection well. So we sort of proposed, I'll go back a slide, kind of an under gravel filter like an aquarium, and we used an airlift pump, which is a really efficient way of moving water at its own level. So we'd pull, you can see how clear the water looks, operating on 2.5 horsepower as opposed to 100. And so this is an article that came out in the West Hawaii Today about an EPA award that we got for business and the environment, and it says, when a chef at the Four Seasons Resort Wailea Lae needs a fish or a shrimp with a dish, a fresh supply is available at the fifth hole golf course. What happened is our client was so good, he recognized how powerful this ecological system was. So he tweaked up the salinity in the pond until he got it, you know, until the plants would wilt. He'd let them adapt. He'd tweak it up a little bit. The plants would wilt. He understood the plants played a very vital role in it. So he got the plants to adapt to a higher salinity, and then he started putting in oysters, Pacific white shrimp, different saltwater fin fish, and then he started serving them at the restaurant of the Four Seasons. Now that's an example of your perfect client. And then the other part that we were really pleased in this article to see is Chai said, if we set up another area as a fish pond, and David Chai was a professional aquaculturalist as well as a pond biologist, if we set up another area as a fish pond without this system, it costs close to $10,000 a month in power. This one runs about $400. This is a slaughterhouse in Hawaii, sort of an odd industry to, you know, for ecologists to be involved in, but there it is. It's dirty water, and you have to ask yourself, do you want to treat dirty water or be really ethical? And sometimes that's a tough choice to make. But this was a slaughterhouse in Oahu. Very high strength waste. Now, the next challenge to come after the Four Seasons was the city, or a company called AZ Environment, approached us, and they needed treatment in the canals in China because they built these cities up very quickly, and they built these large modern cities, but they didn't put any underground infrastructure in, and so there was no sewer. So when you flush the toilet here, it goes, well, you know, here. And here. And here. And so we were challenged with meeting these UN effluent goals. They'd be occasionally tidally flushed out, but there was no regularity to it. And, well, something happened to my text. I was having technical difficulties earlier, so anybody who tried to talk to me, and if I wasn't polite, I apologize. Difficult project to get going. But ultimately, it was successful. And we've just been invited back to do 15 more kilometers of canal. And so, but this was before it was too late. We were doing some propaganda sketches to try and get on the Olympics canals. Sustainable water features. Then we just won an award with the company CH2M Hill, and Wallace Robertson Todd and Garcia and Lopez. The city of Dallas voted to create 150 acres of lakes in their flood zone between the highway and the downtown area. You're going to have Calatrava bridges. It's one of the biggest municipal projects. And we won. We were on the team with CH2M Hill, and we are being tasked with keeping the water looking nice. So we go back and forth between the rest of the team. Well, if it looked nice, it looks nice. It has to be nice. And they say, no, don't worry about it. Just put your pretty things out there and make it look nice. And it's a long story, but people don't understand that we really do have to take these nutrients and contaminants out if we want the water to look nice. And that, and also that, to segue that, is one of the things that I spoke about last night, and I think this morning, is flying into Vancouver once, I had this epiphany as I saw all of the phosphorus on the docks and the nitrogen, and realized the amount of carbon we use to move these nutrients around the globe, and then we grow food, which we then move around the globe, and then we put it in our bodies and contaminate clean water with it. So let's start thinking, when we're thinking about wastewater treatment, and let's also think about nutrient management and keeping that local. And although we have to have the capability, especially during wet season, of getting super high quality tertiary water, we should also keep in mind that we may want to harvest this phosphorus and this nitrogen out of this wastewater in a safe manner, like irrigation of orchards, orchard crops, cover crops, maybe not lettuce, but definitely not lettuce because it's against the law in this country. But any other beneficial crops, just like native switchback grasses, so you can do straw bale construction. fodder crops for animals, wood crops for building of some eco-machines. This is at William McDonough Building at Oberlin College. There you can see they do, the roof water runs off and is treated in a surface flow wetland and then reused within the building. Has an eco-machine for treating of the wastewater, and that is then treated and reused to flushing toilets. Here's one that's one of my favorites because people ask me about maintenance, and this particular client takes great pleasure in abusing this eco-machine and doing very little to it and calling me up every year and telling me how much he's abused it and how well it's working. And the other interesting thing, and this sort of gets back into the not in my backyard, the NIMBY thing, is this was a building built in Ontario, and it was the YMCA Environmental Learning Center event center. So they were going to do weddings, educational things, all sort of back here in this part of the building, which was behind the greenhouse. They ended up doing it all in the greenhouse because they wanted to do it in their wastewater treatment plant, not in this sort of sterile, but, you know, LEED certified building that was behind it, but they liked being in the wastewater treatment environment. So, here's one that we just finished up 2 Aprils ago, and we're just getting phenomenal. It's a recirculating. We had very real space constraints with that one, and. So we had to make it a little smaller than we want, so we made it recirculating. We used renewables to keep it recirculating. We put in a sand filter, but we're getting really phenomenal water chemistry results back. And another thing we did is we put in some conventional engineering things like a sand filter in order to polish that water, because the practice in Exuma, Bahamas is to have deep injection wells, and basically what they do is they take their wastewater and they pump it down in these wells, but what they've discovered in the past 10 years is it has one of the greatest networks of marine caves underneath it. So these guys, it's sort of like climbing Everest. They have to go dive down, and they put more tanks of mixed gas in, and so they can explore these virtually undiscovered ecologies, these worlds, and a couple of the caves they've gone into, and through the roof of the cave they're getting raw wastewater. And so that's obviously not a sustainable thing, but if you think about it, and I'm on a septic system near vernal pool, so trust me, I understand the hypocrisy of it all. This particular project, other than it's very pretty, and I think it worked well for a while, but I know it had some problems with the fats, oils, and greases, which are extremely high in ice cream production. I also know that there's new conventional technologies that can reduce that, so using very little energy, where a natural system could then be effective in removing the remaining nutrients. This sort of shows you how simple, not that we get arrested every time we build one of these, every time we build a natural system, but really how simple it is. You dig a hole to make a wetland, you line it with non-woven geotextile fabric, you put in a distribution header, you fill it full of gravel, and you plant it. And just by that, you're reducing your nitrogen by incredible amounts. You're removing 60% more phosphorus than a conventional plant. And this one, actually, there was an eco machine that was primary to this. This wasn't for full treatment, but this was a polishing wetland before it went to UV and toilet flushing for this Sim Van Drang community at Berea College.
Where is that?
Kentucky, Berea, Kentucky. Interesting town. Nice place to spend 3 weeks. I'm glad it wasn't the whole summer. There you can see that the same wetland after it's matured. And this is the inside of the eco machine. And this was 2 summers ago. This was a problem. We had to collaborate with a local firm and local laws and some site issues, like it was on bedrock, and state law mandated that we had to have a 10,000-gallon septic tank, and so all of the available carbon that's required for these bacterial processes for the removal of nitrates was burned up, and we also had, this is the only system that we had smell issues for. So we went back on our own dime and put these compost filters that actually scrub and some aeration into the septic tank so that we would get rid of the smells. And in addition, we had to add an outside carbon source. That was a design flaw. We learned something from it, that we can't let state laws oversize it, we can work within the state law in order to provide the hydraulic retention, but to use it as something as part of another process, so we're not eating up our carbon. And Kurt in Taos, New Mexico, and that just goes to show you how pretty wastewater treatment can be, and how you're taking wastewater and you then have a viable life form, as you saw with the koi and the Frederick, Maryland system. This is within this. The polishing tanks are inside of the swimming pool area of the resort. We're now working with the Omega Institute, which is a sort of New Age institute for New Age learning and environmental practices, to design a 52,000 gallon a day, which is 1/20th of what you all would need. And we're waiting on our permits right now to break ground on that. We're also waiting to break ground with this one, which is one in Costa Rica, which is going to be an exterior wetland eco-machine hybrid, but there will be no structure in around it. Another one, there's two more subjects that I'm going to broach right now, and a lot of things that we traditionally view as liabilities are, if you look at how nature would do something, are really assets. And to the Magic Hat Brewery, they're spent brewery solids and their liquid waste were a costly liability to them. So by that time, the pilot was over for the South Burlington greenhouse. So we took their liquids and put that in a pilot and cleaned it up to a level where we could grow yellow perch in it. But we also took their brewery grain and mixed it with chicken straw that baby chickens had been raised in, organic chickens, and inoculate it with oyster mushroom spawn that we learned how to do from Paul Stamets. And we were able to, in this mixture, grow oyster mushrooms, which sold for $9.99 a pound at City Market. Now, that's pretty clever right there, but this bag of leftovers after the mushrooms stopped fruiting, when they were mixed with worms in a worm bin, were so powerful that not only did the worms reproduce like crazy, because when things are healthy, I guess they like to reproduce. I wouldn't, we were able to supplement the food for the yellow perch, but the worm castings from this mixture were so powerful. We were able to get this already doing really exciting things, including incubator farms where they take young people, they give them 5 acres, they give them tractors and machinery, they teach them to farm and to market, and then in turn they have to mentor somebody else. And everybody who did it 10 years ago when I was hanging around there, now not only did they incubate other people and teach them, but they all have large local food production farms. They're all getting rid of their food or selling their food locally at higher values. They have very good lifestyles, sustainable lifestyles, and Northern Vermont is one of the, considering how difficult the climate and the farming is one of the most amazingly sustainable food areas that there are, that I've encountered in the country. And finally, this is the pictures of Los Osos, and you guys have some stormwater problems. And the reason I included this is the next series of slides are all about stormwater, and because the second time, both times I read the fine screen report, is I was struck that if there was some sort of different kind of management, which people hit on earlier, of the rainwater that falls on this, couldn't we offset the saltwater intrusion and by the use of better practices? And so these are just some of the practices. Oh, my computer's arguing with me again. It's so sweet. these are just some of the practices that you'll see coming up. Okay, now you can go. But you see, here's a conventional cut curb with 18-inch drain. This is probably all irrigated, mulched annually. It's got the big lights. It probably costs at least five times as much as this one. Now, this one has a low curve. It's bioswale, basically. It's planted with native grasses, which then take the water that flows off of this parking lot and treats it and cleans it through the root systems before it sends it back to the aquifer clean using native plant species. The maintenance is for this bioswale is to burn it once a year. What you get back are beautiful natural native grasses and wildflowers. This, you get Walmart. Permeable pavers, anywhere that a commercial building goes in, the town could mandate or suggest or reward the use of permeable pavements. Because remember that ranch owners, as homeowners, as citizens, that like putting in porous paving in parking lots and putting in rain gardens to offset the impermeable roof systems that we have, and just small and decentralized. And a lot of these things are very inexpensive to do, and they're very decentralized. They don't require a lot of infrastructure. Here's the city of Portland, Oregon has been one of the leaders in stormwater management. Here's a system that they use where they divert the water through scuppers into rain gardens, and what's not able to percolate down goes back out a scupper to the next rain garden, and it keeps going down until so it gets every opportunity to go back into the aquifer clean instead of running into the harbor or the river dirty. There's another, I mean, this could look great here in Los Osos, but here's another rain garden. So to offset the impervious surfaces of the roofs of this community, they put in rain gardens, which also act as a really beautiful landscaping amendment. Green roofs. But green roofs, I don't think, these are nice pictures of green roofs, but when I think about the fact that we want to get our water clean and back into the aquifer to offset the saltwater intrusion, then maybe green roofs aren't the best management practice. Now here's a system, this was a police station in Illinois, and I've left out the photograph that showed the pre-project conditions. But they had 100% runoff. It was a typical suburban police station, impervious roof, impervious parking. Everything was concrete, and all of those stormwater ran off it and polluted a nearby river. So then our colleagues at the Conservation Design Forum out of Chicago, who put the green roof you saw in the City Hall of Chicago, came up with this proposal and implemented it. First they said, let's put it on green roofs where you have buildings and where your buildings can support them. Next, let's put in porous pavement. Finally, let's put in rain gardens, and you'll have a 0% runoff site as opposed to 100% runoff. And it's going back into the water clean. And that's all. Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, thank you, Jonathan. I'm up here for some evening tunes too. So, I think we'll get some lights from the back. And is there a microphone for question and answer that would be available? All right. So.
You better stay up here, too. They might have questions for you,
Noah. Or Michael. Michael, come on up. And if anyone would like to ask a question, maybe about something you're curious about, like to hear more, go ahead. And please say your name for the record.
Test. Okay, now it's working. Thank you for the presentation. My name's Lisa Schicker. I'm on the Los Osos Community Services District Board. And I just had a question for you about endocrine disruptors, what you've found out, what you know about them, and how they work with your system. Thanks.
You always start out with the easy ones, huh? Endocrine disruptors are, 3 years ago, my father had a grad student who wanted to study how, because we had some anecdotal evidence that natural systems with longer retention times were more effective at removing endocrine disruptors. But at that time, the testing for endocrine disruptors was so prohibitive that she was not able to do her doctorate on it, and she had to shift her entire thesis. We only have anecdotal evidence that, especially when you involve the mycelial communities, that you can break down endocrine disruptors to their base elements and break them down more effectively using natural systems than chemical, mechanical systems. But there are people who would argue with me on that one. But we know that they're not being measured by the EPA or the state. We know that they should be. We know they're out there, and we're trying to address them in our designs. But one of the ways that we're trying to do that is we're trying to work with Paul Stamets to have a mycelial, intentional mycelial communities in each and every one of our eco machines.
Hello, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. It's a growing media, and that was unfortunately, we didn't quite hit the lead 600-mile rule with that one, but it was just a very effective, soft material that would decompose once the plants were established without doing any damage to the water.
And you said it was recyclable?
Yeah, and all the plastics were HDP, which were 100% recyclable, as opposed to PVC, which is used in some collection systems, which is very damaging, and it's manufacturing process and also very difficult to recycle.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, how are you tonight? My name's Al, and I have a question. Do you have an email address where I could send you some technical questions? I don't want to take up time with that.
Yeah, I'll give you a card. I think I might have some in my pocket.
Yeah, it looks like it's really flexible. The applications are very mixable, matchable. Want to talk about that?
Yeah, you can really sort of, from a business person standpoint, it would be really easy to do the same thing over and over again. And in my 12 years in the business, I've yet to accomplish doing the same design twice. There always seems to be efficiencies to be gained. Every site is different, every client is different, and every waste stream is a little bit different. So instead of becoming more modular and a better business model, we've become even kind of more adaptive, and we've also become less proprietary as a company. Before we used to have patents, spent a lot of energy protecting our technology, and now we're much more interested in sharing our technology and collaborating with other people, because there's a lot of other people doing really good work, and we want to work with them, not apart from them.
Jonathan, thanks a lot for coming. It was actually very inspiring. It's amazing to think that we can handle all this and have it look so beautiful at the same time. You know, so it's fantastic. Appreciate it. It's my second time seeing your presentation. Couple of questions. One is that you just really brushed over the energy use, but that's something that's really important with regard to natural systems, correct?
When we first started doing eco machines, we were really had to base our process engineering on prolonged aeration. So we were using as much aeration as, say, an activated sludge plant. But since then, we've learned that we can gain efficiencies by ecological sequencing. For instance, knocking. I have to say that a membrane batch reactor is better than nitrogen going into the estuary. There's only one chance at an estuary that took millions of years to evolve.
And well, so, I won't argue with that, but if you had a choice, and I think most of the people here might agree that if you had a choice between what we were seeing up here and the MBR system, I don't think there'd be much of a choice for people.
But, no, I would definitely go for a natural system.
Yeah.
And I'd just look for opportunities instead of... Another thing that sort of, as I've been thinking about this more over the day, is the dry season here is a lot longer than the wet season, and I know it is an upfront capital cost, but where are the opportunities for these waters, and where are the opportunities to harvest also some of these nutrients? And can we, you know, and so instead of just sequestering down into the leach fields, but that's where Los Osos has an opportunity, and, you know, all of the people who work in government are going to jump me outside the building after saying this, but, you know, it's sort of an opportunity to think outside the box and not to put all of your leach fields in one spot, but to spread them out where they can be instead of just, you know, saturating the earth and getting as much water back down into the aquifer as you can, but to spread it out so it's really to an advantage. But it would require, of course, an upfront capital cost.
I keep thinking of more questions, but as you toured around the area, did you saw plenty of space that would be ample space for taking care of all the wastewater in this community then?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And those greenhouses don't look like such bad neighbors.
I'd live next to one. I can say that unqualifiedly. That I would.
So as far as sequestering, I mean, we're talking about carbon neutral and all of that. I mean, we're seeing types of plants that would actually take up the nitrogen and hold the nitrogen. So you're basically taking it out of the cycle, correct? I mean, not nitrogen, but carbon.
Yeah, you could do that. For instance, you could grow fruit trees that would also have a value as a wood after their life as a fruit tree was over, and you could then harvest them as a wood. I know pear wood, apple wood, and then you can use those woods as building materials, and therefore you've effectively sequestered all of that carbon.
One last question. Is the way the process is set up by the county, is a design-build type of situation, and we're going to have, I guess the way it's set up, is there going to be competition, like, for instance, for the treatment? So are you set up to come in with a design-build type of offer?
My question is in regards to scale of these projects. Do you think something like this is possible for, like, even a residential kind of scale? What's the smallest project you've done? And
well, my dad has one in his house.
Yeah.
But, you know, it the one misunderstanding I've run into in this trip the most is, can you do one as big as $1.2 million? Gallons a day. That's easy. The smaller they get, the harder they are, the more biologically delicate they are. What I'm going to do for my house, and because there's no mass regulators here, I can say this, is I am just going to dig a constructed wetland in between my septic tank and my leach field, and I'm going to let it pass through there, and, you know, it'll work on a float valve on a pump that's going to be inside that. Actually, I can actually do it passively because of the gravity. So there'll be no pump, and I'm just going to do probably a 10 by 15 constructed wetland. I'm going to go down to a local marsh, and I'm going to harvest wetland plants, and I'm going to plant that. And that's how I'm going to do my house. But that's not legal. And it's not approved. But the funny thing is, and a local kennel wanted to do that same thing, is between their septic tank and their leach field, they wanted to put a constructed wetland. They can't without doing it as a pilot system. And this is how crazy the bureaucracy is. So they can't afford to do the pilot system because they would have to do so much testing of the water, even though they're only upgrading it in between the tank and where it goes into the ground. So the bureaucracy can be pretty frustrating on the smaller scales. It gets to be exponentially less frustrating on the larger scales because you have to go through these hoops anyway, which you should have to go through. But when you want to do something good on a small level, it can be very difficult if you don't ask, don't tell.
Thank you.
I didn't say that.
Hello, John. Thanks for coming in. It's very exciting and inspiring to see your presentation. And I think a lot of my questions were already asked and answered. First, it sounds like you can handle this, the scale of Los Osos, 5,000 homes, but you'd have to partner with someone.
Yes.
There's kind of a contentious issue in town with collection, a sort of a traditional gravity system, raw sewage versus a step stag type of system. It looked like, at least based on the China example, that
you could do it in HDPE. It would cost a little bit more, but you'd never get that INI. You'd never get the infiltration. It wouldn't fail. It's in a sandy, earthquake-prone area, so you want that flexibility, and so you know that you would have, you could do a gravity system or a step seg system, but so long as you maybe stepped outside the engineering box and use HDPE, which is used for water mains now and for gas, but also use that as a collection system, whether it was gravity or step steg or pressure.
Okay. And then just lastly, have you ever partnered with another firm or a group of firms to do a community the size of Los Osos or a similar size?
No, we are in the process of doing several communities, and we are partnering with people, but we've never come into a community like Los Osos. It's much more new development and retrofitted and brought in a new one. But, you know, to put it in context, South Burlington was about a tenth of your total flow, and that used twice, that was done in 7,500 square feet. And that was using about twice the amount of square feet as we needed, because we needed to get school buses full of children through there and tours, and we were doing a lot of science and within that building. So just that acre and a half up at that one leach field would almost be adequate square footage for greenhouses, and I don't know if that's even possible because of the use of them as leach fields, but would be an adequate space. So if you figured that, just to say 4,000 times 10 is 40. So you need about an acre and a half of greenhouses to do the entire community.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I thought the examples you showed were really wonderful. I guess my question is, how sustainable are these sustainable systems? In other words, how fragile are they over time in terms of management that may not pay attention to all the things you need to do to keep these things, which seem to be a little fragile, and you mentioned at a small scale, it gets easier at a larger scale. And I guess I'm asking the question, what can go wrong over time?
That's a really valid question, because I would say some of our best design systems have had the hardest time, and some of our more mediocre ones have just thrived. And that has been a lot to do with the management. And one of the things that the old company, Living Technology, would say is that here's a turnkey system. And after 12 years of building them, I don't think you can say there's any such thing as a absolutely.
So if management are kind of fight and war, it might not work.
Wait, what
you
was that?
You don't have to answer that.
John, I'm on the wastewater committee, so let me have another shot, okay?
You got it, man. You're wearing a cowboy hat. I'm not going to argue with you.
I can't. When I look at my mirror, it scares me, you know. Wow, who is that guy? Well, I'll tell you what. Let's go with cost per gallon. Let's say you got 100 million gallons, or you could take 100,000, whatever. What do you think your cost per gallon capital cost would be here? In other words, what I'm asking you, can you
work our cost per gallon shrinks the more land you give us, because we put in more wetland. And the more concentrated our footprint, the higher our cost per gallon goes. Also, the larger the system, the cost per gallon. I'm not being proprietary or secretive, but I don't have reliable cost per gallon systems that I can use.
So you're like a pond system. The more you can spread out, the longer you can do the treatment.
And also then we get into the endocrine disruptor thing is like we can meet the EPA and the California State Title 25 standards, no problems at let's just say $18 a gallon, right? But what if we want to hold that little water because we found some more evidence that longer retention times with the mycelial communities are going to actually remove the hormones, the antibiotics, and all of these other things.
Toxins, heavy metals.
Exactly. So there's that. So we go range, but how I answer that question is our cost is, well, there's two ways. At the Omega Project, the sequencing batch reactor, they were bidding $800,000. We came in under $400,000.
How many gallons was that?
52,000. But I say we're equal to, because we can do a more expensive system, or up to 40% less than conventional systems, but with up to 70% lifetime operational savings.
Your carbon footprint is very low. Your energy is very low.
Yes.
And sludge is very low. You have very little end products, so you don't have to ship that.
Well, we want to keep our sludge on site. We want to look at that liability as an asset.
Can you put septage at that end from the septic tanks to into the mix? Can you blend it in versus 350? Well, the next question would be a redwood forest or something of that nature. If we had the footprint, would that be something that you would think of as a viable thing to grow trees? I think one of the things we want to do is we want to have AB 32 has a carbon footprint. We have to be sustainable, uses less energy, but we also want to produce oxygen too. So
I think a redwood forest would be a magnificent thing if we could start a redwood nursery and start a redwood forest. I guess traditionally there were redwoods that came this far down.
Yeah. So you can grow fish in your ponds, you can do all kinds of things, and it looks to me like what you're doing is combining pond treatment with your bio baskets, or your plant baskets, as I saw the screens, right?
Yes.
So you're pulling out the nutrients, and there's a lot of free water in there.
The plants are, as much as pulling out nutrients, and I don't think I made this really clear tonight, the majority of the role of the plant root in the system is to provide a habitat for the bacteria that consume the waste.
How about the oxygen? Where do you supply that with? Would you use solar panels or?
I sure would hope to. I would like to get away from conventional. And an engineer who we work with has said, who does mostly wetlands and doesn't do eco machines, although he does, he says, Jonathan, you got to stop blowing bubbles.
Would 10 acres be enough for you?
What's that?
10 acres, would that be comfortable for this flow?
I got to wrap this up. I'm getting told 10 acres for
million plus gallons.
Do you mean for just wetland or for?
No, if you were going to do your treatment.
We could do it in an acre and a half. So, but I could also use the whole 10 acres if you let me have it.
And you're not. Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Bruce. A comment first. I saw your one area there where you used air to pump water with, basically like blowing a bubble into a pipe and the bubble raises the air. Aero Motors has gone to a small fan that runs a compressor to pump air with, which would be very good in Los Osos where we have more constant wind than we have sunlight for solar.
Yeah, that would be a really interesting concept, and we're always looking at gaining efficiencies for our aeration, so love to hear about it and would always consider that, and we're considering different things in China right now that I've never had any problem with that. I've never heard, we've never had problems with salt buildup because of the flow through in your typical wastewater treatment systems.
Okay, so that's not a problem. Salt's not a problem if I wanted to grow fruit trees and terraces on steep ground with.
Oh, you mean if you were to continually irrigate with treated wastewater? If we were to, it would be something you would need to consider. It would be something you would measure the salinity of the treated wastewater because that could be affected from the very base water where you're getting it from. So you could be getting a saltier water, and therefore you could be applying salts to your soils because you're starting out with saltier water. But then you could intentionally plant plants that would take up some of the sodium in the water as well in the treatment process.
Okay.
And also where your land applying.
One more quick question. With our ponds here to collect storm runoff, we have sediment that it kind of lines the ponds and seals them from absorbing the water. Does that work okay with plants planted in them, different plants, like you had pictures of.
You mean
some
you
of
want? Are you wanting to the water to be retained or not to be retained?
Well, we want to feed the aquifer with the stormwater.
Yeah,
storm
what the plants do is they provide a route for the water molecule to travel down into the. Oh, what we wanted, what the plant roots do is they do break up that sediment layer and they do provide the water molecule path back down into the aquifer, also while being polished.
Okay. We have a clay lined pond over here now that used to be an area that fed Sweet Springs, and now it's a clay lined pond. Can you grow stuff in that will take care of the clay that's the problem there? Or?
I don't know enough about that particular pond or the plants, but I'm sure that there would be there's usually a creative solution that can be found.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming.
How do you do? I have a summing up question having to do with some of the information you gave earlier. For a town, say, of 20,000 people, what would the total footprint of the plant be if you were to receive the effluent, the sewage from 20,000 people in one location? How big do you think you could work? I heard an acre and a half earlier. I wasn't sure if you were...
jazz music. And actually, let's go ahead and thank Mr. Jonathan Todd for coming out.
Thank you, guys.
You can tell the passion is deep.
Yeah. And I apologize to Noah. He's been with me all three PowerPoint presentations, and he's had to hear all this stuff three times. Thank you all so much.
It's finally sinking in. It's finally sinking in. Thank you, John. And John, your reminder, we're here. We're here. Come back anytime. Yeah, and let's go ahead and bring that Cuesta Jazz Ensemble back on out. And I think we have about a little bit of beer left over. Most of you probably have safe rides home, sure. Much more pizza, sliced before bed, help you sleep all night. And please take a look at the silent auction options. And to sum it all up, let's say thanks again to AGP Video for always being there for us. And getting the word out. Cuesta Jazz Ensemble, everyone.